Setlist in association with 7 Digital.
This week, Ticketmaster, Online Harms and Donald Trump. Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I'm Andy Malt. With me is Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
Merry Christmas.
As ever, we...
The reason I said that is because that's what Andy's written in the script.
You always ignore what I put in the script for you, then.
Andy always puts...
It says, ho, 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 Merry Christmas.
In the script, how I should respond to when he says, hello, Chris. And I never do, but I thought this week I would.
All right, then.
Merry Christmas, well, everybody.
Merry Christmas.
This Easter week.
As ever, we're going to be taking a look back through some of the biggest and most interesting music industry news stories of the last week. A week when Billie Eilish revealed that, until relatively recently, she thought the Spice Girls were a fictional band. I mean, I think that's fair.
Well, basically, she thought that Spice World was a This Is Spinal Tap type movie.
Yes.
About a pop group instead of
they
a rock group.
They couldn't possibly exist.
Was what she was thinking. She's been doing a lot of interviews recently, hasn't she?
Yes.
Every single publication
what
in the world.
Bearing an album out and being popular.
A lot of interviews. And it was kind of like the quote, the way it was written up, I suspect it wasn't a good representation of how she said it.
Do you know I transcribed that? Right?
Oh, did you? Yeah. Oh, well, in which case, it was definitely not a good.
I thought you cut some extraneous stuff out.
I thought that we were directly quoting another print publication.
It was different because obviously there was back and forth between her and the
Was it a radio interview then? It was a radio interview. I didn't even know that.
But it was very representative.
Well, it kind of, the way you'd written it up, if it was you, was her basically saying, I couldn't believe there would be a proper band because in the movie they do all sorts of unreal stuff. I mean, because obviously it's a fictionalized version of their lives.
Like jumping a double-decker bus over the Thames.
Rather than it being a biopic. But it kind of, the way you wrote it up implied that she now thinks it's a serious biopic.
Yeah, well maybe she does.
Story of the Spice Girls and all of the things that happened in that movie, which I've never seen, so I don't know what those are, actually happened, where it was a fictional story based on a real group.
Yeah.
A bit like the Monkees, but the other way around, I guess.
She is a young person that they have these days. And she saw that film as a child.
And liked it.
And liked it a lot, watched it a lot. She said she must have seen it at least 40 times. But she saw it after the band had split up, in a period where the band didn't exist. So they might as well have been fictional.
Also, she's American.
Although Spice Girls were quite popular in
America. I know, but they weren't quite the phenomenon that they were here.
But she's a child of the internet age and never thought to Google the Spice Girls, even though she was a big fan of that movie.
Yes, she never read the Wikipedia entry.
So kids these days don't know stuff and are lazy. That's what we can take for this.
Unless the Wikipedia entry for Spice Girls says a fictional group that appeared in the movie Spice World. I mean, who knows?
Could do.
It might do. Hey, do you know what it does prove? Although, did she say that she kind of figured this out about 2 years ago?
Yes.
The last time there was...
Because they announced they were reforming and initially she went, wow, they're going to, like, what, reenact the movie? And then she realised they were an actual band who were going to perform and had a life beyond being in a weird film.
Because I was going to say, it proves she doesn't read the CMU Daily. But it was around about that time, wasn't it? Where pretty much Jan finally bit every single day in the CMU Daily for about a month. Was will they, won't they, will they, won't they?
Yeah.
They're going to do this, they're not going to do that. Well, at least that means that quote isn't proof that the biggest music sensation of the moment doesn't read the CMU Daily. Because I'm sure she's an avid reader.
Well, either that, she might just listen to Setlist, the podcast.
That's
from
true.
CMU, which is how some people choose to live their life.
It is. Weird.
Anyway,
people.
This isn't what we're here to talk about this week. In fact, we are going to be discussing the UK government's new online harms proposals. It's proposals against online harms, not for. But who knows? I mean, our government's gone nuts, hasn't it? Anyway, specifically, we're going to be talking about what it means for music piracy. Spoiler, nothing. And we're also going to be talking about Donald Trump's clash with Batman. But first, a law firm in Widnes, for anyone who doesn't know, is, I mean, that's like everyone, isn't it? I mean, even people in the UK don't know where Widnes is.
I know where it is.
Except you, I was going to come on to that, because you're basically from Widnes.
Well, I'm not from Widnes, but I'm from near Widnes.
Yeah, it's basically the same. Widnes is a town in Cheshire. Cheshire is a county in the north of England.
I don't even know, because you've taken that straight out of my write-up on this in the aforementioned CMU Daily.
Mm.
I don't even really know why the fact this law firm's based in Widnes is relevant.
I just thought it was weird.
I think that's probably why it was. I mean, that's a horribly London-centric way to be, isn't it? Particularly from someone who comes from near there, to assume that a law firm that's pursuing a landmark case in data protection has to be based in London rather than up north.
Yeah.
But for some reason, I felt the need to share in the story. And Andy felt the need to then put that into set.
And it's basically made up the bulk of this section already. Maybe we should just talk about Widnes.
This law firm.
I like the name Widnes. I've always liked the name Widnes. It definitely, it's a funny word, isn't it?
Did you look it up? Is it definitely Cheshire, not Merseyside?
It's Cheshire.
I think it must be kind of on the border between Cheshire and Merseyside, I reckon. But anyway.
We're getting a bit too much into local geography.
Tell us about this law firm from Widnes.
Well, I've told you all I know about it.
But what they've done this
week. It's a law firm from Widnes. But it's done something.
That's made it music news.
You've already alluded to. It has filed a lawsuit against Ticketmaster. The Ticketmaster is not based in Widnes.
No.
So there's no reason for this not to be in London. Anyway, it's filed a lawsuit in relation to the security breach that occurred to the Live Nation-owned ticketing firm last year.
Yes. So this was quite big news at the time.
In Widnes and other places.
Not just in Widnes. Mainly in the UK, although it had a little bit of a global element to it as well. So it was last June, if you remember last June. Do you remember last June?
No.
Last June was the month when Ticketmaster UK confirmed that it had had one of those trendy data hacks where a little security breach had been found on its system. Actually, it was another technology that it was using on its platform that somehow had something in it that allowed people to come in and grab information, data, about Ticketmaster's customers. So they said last June, we've identified this issue on our platform and we are alerting lots and lots of Ticketmaster customers that their data may well have been grabbed.
In data breach terms, not lots and lots. They reckon up to 40,000 people. And whereas, like, you'd get data breaches of hundreds of millions of people. Let's put it in perspective. However, I mean, it sounds like Ticketmaster were following protocol and informing their customers and saying, we should change your passwords. And sorry, we might have leaked some of your personal information on the internet. But there's another little caveat to this,
which is mentioned in the lawsuit, so we should mention it here.
And that was sometime earlier, I think in April last year, online bank Monzo had noticed some irregularities on some of its customers' accounts and identified it as a problem with Ticketmaster and gone to Ticketmaster and said, we think you've had a data breach. And then Ticketmaster said, oh, I'll have a look at that. That sounds interesting. And then went back and went, no, it's fine. Nothing wrong. Fine. Which was wrong because, as we learned later from Ticketmaster, they had a data breach.
And one of the reasons we know all of that is because Monzo is one of those trendy digital banks.
Yeah.
They have a blog and their staff blog on their blog. And they wrote a long article as soon as Ticketmaster had come out and said, yeah, there was a security breach. We're having to let lots of people know that their data may have been grabbed. They then put their side of the story online almost immediately saying, yeah, we told Ticketmaster this 4 months ago. And then they talked about what they had done, because they'd reissued a load of credit cards as a precaution as soon as they realised this stuff was happening. So we got to see Monzo's side of the story almost as soon as Ticketmaster had confirmed. But yeah. Crucially, because this is also mentioned in the lawsuit, that happened in April.
Yeah.
And Ticketmaster didn't actually say anything to their customers until June.
Yes.
And that's where, in the litigation that is now being filed, one of the lines being put out by the legal firm from Widnes, who are leading on this, is, well, what was happening in those 2 months? Ticketmaster is saying that they felt that they dealt with the incident in an appropriate way, but the allegation is they should have dealt with it a lot faster.
Yes, because actually now they reckon, I mean, they haven't confirmed exactly how many people were affected, but it's thought to be up to 40,000. But it's potentially anyone who bought tickets from either the main Ticketmaster UK website or its sister sites, Ticketweb and Get Me In, between February and June last year could have been affected by this, could have had their details stolen. And that's quite a big window.
Now, interestingly, Ticketmaster confirmed this had happened in June, almost a month to the day after the entire European Union, everybody who lives in the EU, had had data protection law thrust into their faces for a few weeks. Mm. Because, of course, the General Data Protection Regulation, GDPR, had become law. So everyone was much more aware at that time about data protection law. Most people were a little bit confused as to actually what GDPR meant.
As far as anyone knew, it just meant lots of emails.
Lots of very annoying emails so that you wouldn't subsequently receive lots of annoying emails.
Yeah.
But the point was that Ticketmaster was admitting to this security breach and this data grab just a few weeks after everybody had been talking about the responsibilities of big companies when it comes to the data that they collect on their customers. And Ticketmaster did say quite quickly after they'd confirmed security breach that they felt that they had complied with the law and the rules on how to deal with incidents like this, and they said they felt they were compliant with GDPR. Although, of course, the interesting thing is the actual breach, we now know, because of what Monzo told us, the breach actually happened in April, which was pre-GDPR. So there's a thing called the Information Commissioner's Office, which oversees data protection law here in the UK. And they've been investigating ever since this began. And they did admit quite early on that they were still trying to work out, because the breach had happened before GDPR kicked in, but Ticketmaster confirmed it to their customers afterwards. Mm. So if we're applying any law in this case, which now it's looking like it's going to go to court, a judge will have to apply some law, is, well, which law? Is it data protection law that was already in place pre-last May, or is it the new data protection law put in place by GDPR? And no one really seems that certain.
Yes. Now, so this law firm from Widnes, Hayes Connor, which specialises in data protection, which is why they're leading on it, despite having been very flippant about it earlier on in this piece, they've been encouraging Ticketmaster customers affected by the breach to get in touch with them for a while now. They say they've now got over 650 people affected by this and have filed their litigation with the High Court in Liverpool. The law firm's managing director, Kingsley Hayes, told reporters that they'd gone legal after unsuccessful negotiations to try to agree an out-of-court settlement with Ticketmaster.
Elsewhere in the statement this law firm issued earlier this month, as they confirmed this lawsuit had been filed, they noted, as we've already noted, how Ticketmaster took a good couple of months after being made aware of the issue by Monzo to actually tell their customers. And then they honed in on the impact that this has had on the 650-odd people that they are representing in this case. They said, more than two-thirds of our clients have suffered multiple fraudulent transactions since the serious data breach, while the rest are still at risk of having their data used in fraudulent ways. And they then talked about how, because as you say, they're data protection law specialists. They do a lot of work in this area.
Yeah.
And they were saying that when you have significant data breaches, and okay, as you said, in the wider scheme of things, 40,000 people isn't that much, because it could have been millions, but it is still a significant data breach. And one thing that the law firm was noting was how they've noticed in the past that when significant amounts of data are taken, quite often what happens is whoever it is that has taken them and is planning on using that data for fraudulent purposes tends to use chunks of the data at a time. Mm. So they don't use all of the stolen data in one go. They'll take a chunk of it, try and do some fraudulent activity, knowing that at some point all of those card numbers and passwords will cease to work. And then they take another chunk and they have a go at that, and another chunk and have a go at that. So basically what they're saying was, although a third of the people they are representing haven't actually had any fraudulent transactions yet as a result of this, even though we're, you know, not far off a year on from this happening, past precedent has suggested that they could still be at risk.
Yes.
So I suppose that was why they were saying, even for the third of claimants who have not actually seen any fraudulent transactions, they could as yet still suffer. And then they were talking about the stress that that, and obviously they're trying to ramp up the impact this has had on this 650 people. And they were talking about the stress that that can cause for the people who had their data stolen.
So as we record this, Ticketmaster hasn't responded to this case, although we do know that the UK's National Crime Agency and the Information Commissioner's Office are already investigating as well. So there could be further legal action from that. So there's possibly more fallout from this to come.
And the law firm, still in witness, we're also inviting anybody else who is aware that their data was taken as a result of the Ticketmaster data hack to get in touch, because you could still join the lawsuit if you so wish. They're suing for up to 5 million.
Would that go up if there's more people added, though?
I don't quite know, because I must admit I didn't read the lawsuit to the end. So I didn't really read what they were claiming as far as damages are concerned. But basically they're saying, if you want a cut of that, assuming they are successful, that's still obviously to be seen, but you can still participate if you so wish. If it does get to court, it will be interesting, because obviously, even if it ends up being that the case centres on pre-GDPR data protection law, because data and privacy is a big talking point, and obviously it was a particularly big talking point around GDPR last year, but I mean, it has just become a much bigger talking point in the last couple of years anyway. And obviously Ticketmaster, massive company just generally, certainly significant player in the live music industry. It will be interesting to see how that went if it did indeed get to court.
Still to come, how Donald Trump's attempt to frame himself as a dark knight climbing out of a pit got him in trouble with Hans Zimmer. But now, The UK government last week unveiled plans for a new internet regulator that will seek to encourage, pressure and force digital platforms to do more to stop what ministers are calling online harms.
Yes, the British government took a couple of hours off the nation falling apart, trying to work out what the hell is happening with Brexit, although currently looks like not a lot is happening with Brexit. So they took a couple of hours off from that and they headed down to the British Library to launch this white paper on what the government wants to do about what it is calling online harms. And the speech that, well, both the Culture Secretary and the Home Secretary are part of this, because it has, obviously has a culture media element, but also a criminal law element. Mm. So both of them were involved. Both their speeches are available online. The Culture Minister had quite a tedious opening paragraph where he was trying to justify why they picked the British Library, basically saying, well, the internet's kind of the modern library, isn't it? Words to that effect. So that was how they justified it. But despite that, it is an interesting document that they have published. Mm. And it's kind of a catch-all mishmash document, because obviously...
of the sort the UK government's very very prone to putting together.
And this is the latest
Especially when it comes to the internet.
Because in recent years, obviously, there have been a number of different debates as internet usage has exploded and gone truly mainstream and as social media has taken off and as YouTube and other user-generated content platforms have exploded. Lots of debates have been going on about issues created once everybody talk and publish and communicate and put stuff out there to a global audience on the internet. And there have been various discussions about what government and the state and internet companies could or couldn't do in order to overcome some of the issues. And as I say, these issues have been grouped under the banner online harms, which could cover a huge number of different things.
Oh, and actually, it does.
In the white paper, they have a whole page where they list what it is that they mean by online harms, and it is a pretty long list.
So there's cyberbullying, cyber stalking, disinformation, revenge porn, incitement of violence, the distribution of terrorist or violent content, images of child abuse, children accessing pornography and other unsuitable content, and the online sale of illegal goods.
And that is not actually the full list. That's edited highlights of the list.
It does not include, though, copyright infringement.
It doesn't. You will notice, although it talks about criminal activity happening online and people selling drugs and weapons and things through online channels, there is no mention of intellectual property issues, of selling counterfeit goods or of distributing copyright material without license. Now, regular listeners to Setlist might think, well, wasn't that what the Copyright Directive was about? Have we not spent the last 3 years talking about what governments can do to encourage / force internet companies, internet platforms to do more to protect copyright? And you would be right to think that.
Yeah.
Because we have talked about that
a lot.
At great length.
Well done for thinking that.
So, presumably, that's why, despite having quite a miscellaneous mix of online harms covered by this white paper, intellectual property and copyright was not in there. But the Record Industry Trade Body, BPI, did express disappointment at that, saying that when the government had published its digital charter last year, which kind of preempted this white paper, intellectual property was part of the conversation. Mm. So although you might think, can we stand another 2 to 3 years of talking about intellectual property online? I think the BPI felt that, okay, yes, maybe some things have been addressed by the European Copyright Directive, although it's still TBC as to whether or not that will even be implemented here.
Yes.
But even if it is, I think that the record industry and the wider music industry, for that matter, still thinks that although maybe some issues have been addressed in the European Copyright Directive, there are still some other issues. Take down and stay down, I think, would be one of the things that the record industry would raise. So obviously, under the much talked about Safe Harbor, which was a big part of the Copyright Directive conversation, companies like YouTube and Google and server hosting companies and internet service providers can be protected from liability for copyright infringement. YouTube possibly not now, as a result of the Copyright Directive. But lots of other internet companies will still have that safe harbor protection, providing they remove content that is infringing copyright when made aware of it by a copyright owner. But the record industry feels that a lot of companies don't have particularly efficient takedown systems. They have the safe harbor protection, but their takedown systems are a bit shoddy, which means as a copyright owner, you're constantly having to reissue to the same organizations takedown notices relating to the same content. Of course, the irony is when it comes to that element of the safe harbor debate, trying to get safe harbor rules refined so that safe harbor protected companies are obliged to offer a takedown and stay down content management system. The irony is, on that side of the safe harbor debate, YouTube's kind of the best player because in Content ID, they're already doing that. Whereas Google Search, for example, do not, and lots of other internet companies do not. So the music industry, although they may have got a little bit of safe harbor reform in the European Copyright Directive that increases the liabilities of websites like YouTube, still have some issues with the takedown element of safe harbor. And I think they were hoping that that could have been part of this discussion, but it isn't.
Yeah, so BPI boss Jeff Taylor said in his response to this, IP infringement is one of the biggest inhibitors to the growth of our creative industries at a time when they should be one of the UK's top priorities after Brexit. We strongly urge the government to listen to the many concerned voices across the wider creative community and to think through its approach again. I mean, there's a lot of top priorities after Brexit, aren't there? There's a lot of top priorities before Brexit. It's just, yeah, framing anything in Brexit terms is difficult.
It is. But Brexit or no Brexit, I sense that the government aren't in any mood to stick copyright into this white paper. If they did, that lobbying machine that has been very busy over the last couple of years in Brussels, especially the last 6 months, lobbying against the Copyright Directive on behalf of the tech sector, would be able to immediately divert its attentions to this in the UK. Although actually, they're almost certainly going to do that anyway, even without any copyright and piracy in there. What the white paper is basically proposing for those online harms that it has decided are within its remit is that a new duty of care be applied to an assortment of internet companies, including the user-generated platforms that were very much the focus under the Copyright Directive, and that those platforms, as a result of that duty of care, will have responsibility for ensuring that violent content and disinformation and sort of cyberbullying, when people are attacking individuals through online channels, that they take responsibility for ensuring that that can't happen. And crucially, as you've already said at the outset, as part of that, the proposal is a new regulator will be set up. They weren't quite clear about whether it would be a brand new regulator or whether ultimately this will end up sitting under the media regulator Ofcom, but that a new regulator would be set up to ensure that internet companies were meeting this new duty of care, and it would have the power to fine companies that didn't and possibly have some other sanctions available to it as well, including potentially the ability to instigate web blocks, something we talk about quite a lot on Setlist in the context of copyright. But internet companies that were not complying with these new responsibilities could, if they were persistently not complying, see their websites being blocked in the UK.
Critics of this have already raised free speech concerns, as always, that is normal. And Culture Minister Jeremy Wright did acknowledge that there would be a big challenge in getting the balance right between stopping online harms and protecting free speech. He didn't really go into specifics, but at least acknowledged that he was aware of that. And we'll see if the tech industry is placated. I mean, it won't be, but you know, we'll at least get to watch and pretend that something might change.
Yeah, so the free speech element will be a big part of this. Now, obviously, free speech is always raised when new copyright rules are coming in, and it was raised multiple times during the whole European Copyright Directive debate, particularly around the safe harbour reform. And I think quite often when free speech is raised in the context of a copyright debate, it's not always a brilliant argument. I mean, with the safe harbor reform in the European Copyright Directive and the new responsibilities for user upload platforms, there was the element of if YouTube and any other website like YouTube has to have ever more rigorous filtering of content looking for copyright infringement, what if somebody uploads something that does use somebody else's music or somebody else's film, but it's covered by a copyright exception, so like the parody exception.
Yeah.
And that is a valid point, and that is kind of a free speech issue. But often the free speech element on the copyright side is exaggerated by the tech sector and other people who are critical of expansion of copyright rules. But I think with some of the issues covered by this online harms document, like hate speech and fake news and indecent content, you do immediately have the issue of, well, who is to define what is hateful, what is fake, and what is indecent? Because all three of those are very much open to interpretation. And so you end up in a massive conversation about, well, where do you draw the line? Who is making that judgment call? Particularly if we're saying to companies like Facebook and Twitter and YouTube. You've got to be making this judgment call every day of the week, millions of times a day, as content is uploaded. And it was interesting that the Open Rights Group, which is an organization that is always critical of this kind of stuff, whether it's copyright-led or whether it's dealing with the issues raised in this online harms white paper, but they were saying, but most internet companies, Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, etc., are already doing quite a lot of work to try and reduce the online harm on their platforms.
Yes.
And to an extent, that's correct, although I think in many cases, it's possibly too little too late. Certainly it's too late. Whether or not it's too little, I suppose we could have a debate about. But they were basically saying, well, they're already doing everything they can, which you may or may not agree with. But their point was, if you agree that the company's already doing all they can, then where is this new duty of care going to draw the line? Because if they interpret this new duty of care in quite a narrow way, their argument was, well, internet companies are already doing that, so actually this new law will have no difference on what happens on the internet. Or they interpret this new duty of care in a very wide way, and then they were saying, then a whole assortment of freedom of speech and freedom of expression issues will be raised. And although the white paper does raise the free speech issues, I suppose, like the culture minister's statement at the launch, it acknowledges the challenges, but it doesn't really go into any great detail about how it's going to deal with those issues and challenges.
Well, I think politicians have a tendency to just assume that there's some way of automating this with amazing technology, but they don't know what that technology is, and it doesn't exist, or doesn't exist in the form they assume that it does or could.
That's like
it's the same as the Northern Ireland border, to bring up Brexit again. Technology will sort that out. It won't.
I remember when we used to have an office in Edinburgh during the Edinburgh Festival, and we used to take over a flat in the middle of Edinburgh and ran it as an office. And then one year when we got there, the person who owned the flat had switched over to TalkTalk as an internet service provider just before we got there. And because it was a brand new account, it had TalkTalk's default parental settings installed on the router, which was in line with, that was a David Cameron thing, wasn't it?
Yeah.
But it meant that I couldn't access WordPress and I couldn't access any social media. But weirdly, through Google, you could access sites which clearly the system was trying to stop you from accessing.
Yeah.
So that was trying to fall in line with David Cameron's mission, and it was utterly useless.
Well, it's like when we just do this, the porn block that was legislated for in the UK and keeps getting put back because actually the technology doesn't work, you can't really do it. And then there's this whole thing of like, now you're going to hand over your credit card information to porn companies in order to look at porn. Or they're talking about a system where you could go into newsagents and buy a card that will let you look at porn once. It was weird. I mean, that's like going back and buying magazines. maybe that's going to revive the magazine industry.
And as our first story on this edition of Setlist.
But once again, that was another example of politicians going like, they'll just have some quick and easy technology that will do all that. No, it doesn't really exist.
And given our first story on this edition of Setlist, people will be ever more concerned about handing over their credit card information,
yes,
and the data information to anybody, let alone to some sort of porn company. And of course, there is always that thing, isn't there, that the people that things like that are trying to protect, trying to freeze out from accessing that sort of content, are often the most web-savvy people living in your country, who will almost immediately work out a way around it.
Yes.
So yes, the government has a long history of coming up with rather simplistic, unrealistic solutions to problems like this. So it will be interesting to see, as this white paper develops, and presumably the aim is to push it through into drafting some legislation, whether or not it's just full of a whole load of other deluded, simplistic solutions. I suspect it probably will be, but we will see.
Yeah. Before our last story this week, just quickly time for a little bit of plugging. What have you got to plug this week, Chris Cook?
We ought to update Great Escape news.
Okay.
It's getting very close, the Great Escape. It's just a few weeks away. And once again, CMU is presenting 3 full-day conferences as part of the Great Escape this year. We did talk about it on a recent edition of Setlist, so I won't go into it in any great detail. We have our music education focus on the Wednesday, the 8th of May, our digital dollars streaming digital royalties focus on the Thursday, the 9th of May, and then everything to do with how music marketing is evolving on the Friday, that's the 10th of May. But we have put our schedules live for those 3 days on both the CMU Insights and the Great Escape website. So if you're planning on coming along, you can work out what's happening when. Plus, each of our 3 days will be ending with a one-on-one keynote in conversation, which will be linked to that day's conversations, although in some ways will also be standalone conversations. And so we'd already announced that Cassandra Gracie, who runs the fourth floor creative division of Sony Music here in the UK, will be wrapping up our marketing day, talking about why Sony decided to set up a whole separate division that would have all of the creative, video content, analytics, partnerships, all in one place, working across their labels in the UK. And we'll be talking to her about that division, why it was set up, and how music marketeers are having to create ever-increasing amounts of content and video and stuff to go with their marketing campaigns. So that's happening on the Friday of TGE. At the end of our Digital Dollars Day on the Thursday, we'll be joined by Justin Kalavowicz, who is the CEO and founder of Downtown Music, the American independent music publisher. Very interesting business, because as well as being a significant independent publisher with operations in multiple countries, including here in the UK, they also have the SongTrust platform, which is helping lots of songwriters and other publishers better manage their rights online. And we're going to be having a big focus as part of our Digital Dollars strand on the challenge of managing song rights and royalties, particularly in the streaming space. And that's a very interesting platform in that domain.
And they've just bought CD Baby.
And then very recently, they bought the company which owns CD Baby and some other digital marketing companies. So it's very interesting maneuvering going on there in creating a company that has services for both artists and songwriters now at the grassroots DIY level, but then obviously working with those artists up in a hierarchy and doing more traditional full-on publishing as well. So we're going to talk to him about the Downtown business, how it's got to where it is now, and what his future ambitions are, and sort of the ever-evolving role of publishers and labels in the music industry as we shift to streaming. And on the Wednesday, at the end of our education day, we'll be joined by the one and only Chilly Gonzalez.
Yeah.
Quite exciting for me.
Yes, let's see. I mean, that'd be fun to go and see that, just to see if Chris can manage to ask any relevant questions, or just be a fanboy.
So my favourite artist of all time, Chilly Gonzalez, will be joining us on stage. But it's not just because I fancied having my favourite music maker on stage for an hour to talk to. That's not the only reason he's there.
I almost said mainly, but no, it actually has something very relevant to talk about.
So he launched his Gonservatory last summer. So that's his own music summer school, where basically he got a bunch of musicians and he brought them to Paris. And they took part in a whole load of really interesting educational stuff, masterclass stuff, creating music. There were concerts at the beginning and the end of the project. He got all of his musical mates along, so Jarvis Cocker et al, to come and participate with them. And he has lots of opinions on how music should be taught and how young music creators should be encouraged to collaborate.
Well, he did that book as well that was supposed to help people who had sort of learned piano as a child but then given it up get back into it and in a kind of easy way.
And so we're going to be talking to him about all of those projects. And there's a bunch of videos online that he has made for various different media over the years where he does that thing that I really love, which is where he'll take whatever the main pop song of the moment is, so the latest Taylor Swift track, say, but then he'll dissect it in a way that a classical musician will understand. So he'll say, if you're from a classical background, let me explain to you what's going on in this Taylor Swift song. That's exactly the same as what a classical musician would do. The techniques are the same. The ambitions are the same. It just sounds very different to you because it's pop music, not classical music. Or if you're a jazz music person, let me talk to you about this in the context of jazz music. And one of our features of the education conference, because it's all about trying to get music educators in the music industry, but then all the different strands of music education better connected, talking to each other. And so there'll be this idea of, well, if you come from a classical tradition, but you find yourself in a schoolroom teaching people whose passion is grime, it might feel like your classical music and the grime that they are making are universes apart, but actually the mechanics of the music and the music making process is quite similar. You're just using very different terminology and the output sounds quite different. And so we're going to chat to him about that as well at the conclusion of our education day, which is on the Wednesday. So actually, remember, the conference kicks off the day before the festival. So if you can get down on the Wednesday for our focus on music education, and then we'll be chatting to Chilly Gonzalez at the end of that day. Check out all the information on either the Great Escape website or the Seamute Insights website. And see you in Brighton in May.
So you'll find links to find out more about all that stuff and everything we've discussed this week if you go to setlistpodcast.com and click on the show notes for this episode. And finally this week, Twitter has taken down a campaign video for Donald Trump's re-election in 2020 after the Warner Brothers movie studio issued a takedown notice. This was because the video used music from the soundtrack of Batman film The Dark Knight Rises, which the studio said had been used without permission.
Now, although this story was quite amusing,
yep,
even though it's the latest in a long line of people complaining about Donald Trump nicking their content for yep. his campaigning, but it was an amusing story. It was also a deeply depressing story that he's already on the campaign circuit for his re-election for a second term of
well,
having
he's
a go.
Well, been doing campaign rallies since he became president. It's
that
been
is
quite
true.
Odd.
Because he did his victory circuit, didn't he? So his victory circuit of going and doing rallies and then his starting rallies for the next election kind of morphed in yeah. the middle. But not only is he out there campaigning for his second term, he's already posting content on the internet.
Yeah, and in quite a strange way, because it used images from The Dark Knight Rises again. So he's sort of framing himself as a dark knight. The bit of music he used, composed by Hans Zimmer, is called Why Do We Fall? It soundtracks a scene in The Dark Knight Rises where Bruce Wayne falls in a pit and has to climb out. So I don't know if he's saying that America is a pit he's trying to climb out of, or politics is a pit. I mean, he talked about draining the swamp. I mean, he also, on the tweet that he posted this video in, said Make America Great Again, which is sort of it's a weird thing to start your campaign going, this is what I said last time and I haven't done it. But give me another 4 years, I'll have another go.
This time.
I'll climb out of this pit.
We'll make it
and
great
make
again.
Make America great again.
I suppose Batman's a billionaire who ultimately fixes problems in society. And maybe that was kind of what you're doing. He was that
he
clever.
He blows a lot of stuff up in the process.
Well, yes. I think quite a lot of Donald Trump's supporters quite like the idea of things being blown up.
I guess Donald Trump's an orphan.
In that both his parents have died because he's quite old.
Yes.
And the Democrats are going to put the Joker up as their candidate. Is that what you're saying?
It could be.
Or it was me who started on the making Donald Trump the political version of Batman line. But yeah, so latest complaint about him nicking some copyright material. It was the Warner Brothers movie studio,
yes,
not to be confused with the Warner Brothers record company, because they're no longer the same thing, that put in the complaint. But I suppose if we want to take this story down the classic set list tedious copyright law line, should we
which
do
we do.
Stop trying to compare Donald Trump to Batman and go with the tedious copyright law. The interesting thing, isn't it, is that when people like Donald Trump use other people's music in their campaigning and then people complain, sometimes it's because the music has been used at an event. Sometimes it's because the music has been used in like a YouTube video or a Twitter video, as it was in this case. And in the former, generally, there's nothing the musician or the copyright owner can do, whereas in the latter, there is.
Yes, because actually in the last presidential campaign, we reported a lot on musicians complaining about Donald Trump using their music at his rallies. Generally, all they could do was just complain and say, we don't want to be associated with this guy, because the use of that music was covered by the blanket licenses of the venues where he was speaking. And although some artists did try to go down legal routes, really, they were trying to force him to stop doing it. You know, none of them went to court. They just wanted him to stop. And generally, I mean, certainly in the case of Steven Tyler from Aerosmith, he got his lawyer to send a letter threatening legal action. And Donald Trump went, yeah, okay, I'll stop using it.
In most cases, he stopped using it once it became a media story, yes, didn't it? And he would just find some other song to use.
But in this case, it is actually infringement because he's used it in an online video. And we have seen artists actually go legal against politicians doing this in the past. And I don't think any of those cases have ever got to court, but they have generally settled out of court. There was David Byrne was a particularly high profile case like this. I think Don Henley from the Eagles as well. Although that was a slightly, there was a parody element to that. But again, that was someone going legal over the use of their music in an online video where there is an actual legal case to be argued.
Yeah, because the blanket licenses, which are administrated by the collecting societies like BMI and ASCAP, apply to venues where events may be taking place. Also, obviously, in the US, you have the fact that on the sound recording side, there's a limitation on the performance side. So whereas here in the UK, the public performance of sound recordings is protected by copyright, actually, in most cases in the US, it isn't, although you can try and enforce on the song side. But generally, if it's at an event and the venue has a license on the song side through a BMI and an ASCAP, there's not a great deal you can do. But the minute you synchronize that music into a video and you stick it up online, then there is a much more straightforward copyright case to be answered, which is why pretty much as soon as the Warner Brothers Studios had a good moan about that Donald Trump video, they didn't ask Donald Trump to withdraw it. They just got Twitter to take it down.
Yes, the tweet remains. The video is no longer available.
So you can't see Donald Trump being Batman.
No, I don't think he was being Batman. But that video is no longer there. And it remains to be seen if Warner Brothers tries to take further legal action on it. I mean, I suspect they won't, but they could, and that would be fun. But at the start of Donald Trump's presidency, we were talking about a review of copyright going on within Congress. And I'm not sure if anything has ever come of that, but it suggests that Donald Trump hasn't read anything that came out of that.
Well, that was all about safe harbor reform, wasn't it? Yeah, we're still waiting for the review of safe harbor that the Copyright Office undertook a couple of years ago now. Although we have had the Music Modernization Act under his presidency, a major piece of copyright reform. So there has been some copyright conversations going on in the White House. I mean, that wasn't Donald Trump-driven legislation, but he signed it.
He did.
So that doesn't mean he read it.
Then he got distracted by Kanye. He probably forgot all the copyrights.
Probably did. Hence the Twitter video.
Yeah. So it's Kanye's fault, who also may be standing for the 2020 election.
He could be the Joker.
Okay, well, that's sorted then.
All coming together at the end of this edition of Setlist.
Well, good. That wraps it up nicely. Let's bring this episode to an end. Why don't you talk about our podcast on your podcast, which I assume you have.
Everyone's got a podcast now.
Matt Farley, Moton Media, the latest episode of his show. It's a very nice mention of Setlist. I mean, he's mainly talking about me. Talking about me being great.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because I emailed him about Cadbury's Cream Eggs.
Right.
But he did talk about Setlist. No, he said Setlist was a great podcast. And he also said Complete Music Update was very good. I think he said great about that. But I think the most important thing is he said I was great.
Well, that's good.
And he is also great.
Yes.
So that's everyone's great.
Maybe.
No one's said nothing about Chris Cook as yet. Maybe you could talk about Chris Cook on your podcast.
We could sneak in the song he wrote about you.
Yeah.
Or the song he wrote about me.
Yeah, mine better.
Without permission, and then we'd have some copyright infringement at the end of the podcast. Or we could do a bit more critical analysis like you did last week, but you were very rude about the track we put in last week's set list.
I wouldn't be rude about my song.
In order to qualify for critical analysis. Right.
Go to my website if you want to hear that song. It's right up on the front page.
Is it?
AndyMolt.com. Setlist is the music business podcast from CMU. It's presented by Andy Molt and Chris Cook. It's produced by Matt Peaty, edited by Jason Wolfe. And for more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.
Recorded at unique facilities, Setlist is an unlimited production.